This is Chris Martin, the host of Half Hour of Heterodoxy. Before we start the show, a quick announcement. Heterodox Academy is now accepting applications for the HX Community's Small Events Reimbursement Award. We have 10 awards of up to $500 each available between January and August 2020 to support small events organized by members of HX Community's groups. You can use that money to organize a mixer, a pre-conference or conference, or a live or online workshop. This is an exciting opportunity to engage with other heterodox thinkers and to support HXA in developing the HX Communities Initiative. There are now HX Communities in anthropology, classics, economics, psychology, sociology, and rhetoric and composition. There are also communities for community colleges, higher education leadership, and K-12 education, and local communities for Australia and New Zealand. To learn more, go to heterodoxacademy.org/about-HX-disciplines-initiative. If you're not familiar with HX Communities, please visit heterodoxacademy.org for more information or email membership@heterodoxacademy.org.
Welcome to Half Hour of Heterodoxy, featuring conversations with scholars and authors and ideas from diverse perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Jill DeTemple is my guest today. She's an associate professor of religious studies at Southern Methodist University. She uses a technique called reflective structured dialogue to enable students to express their perspectives on contentious moral and religious issues. This technique was created by a nonprofit called Essential Partners, formed in the 1980s after a series of abortion clinic shootings in Boston. It comes out of family therapy, and we talk about the technique in this interview. Her work in this area has won her the American Academy of Religion 2018 Excellence in Teaching Award. Among the courses she teaches at SMU are Social Scientific Approaches to the Study of Religion, Problems in the Philosophy of Religion, and Religious Literacy. She also teaches a course on Latinx identities called Identity and the Sacred in the Southwest at the Taos, New Mexico campus of SMU. So tell me a bit about the origins of reflective structure dialogue and how you learned about it.
So reflective structure dialogue comes from a nonprofit called Essential Partners. They used to be called Public Conversations Project, and it started in the late 80s when a group of family therapists was watching the discourse around some shootings at abortion clinics in Boston. And they noticed that the really dysfunctional discourse they were seeing looked a whole lot like really bad family discourse, where you're in those stuck conversations. You think you know what somebody else is going to say before you even hear them say it. And as a result, you're shutting down and you're not hearing anything. And so they got interested in this and decided to try using some of the techniques that they had developed in that public conversation, although it was done very privately, in secret, actually, as I understand it. And they got a bunch of people together on all sides of this issue, and they brought them into a room, and they developed this mode of speaking and listening, which is now called reflective structured dialogue. And they were really pleased with what happened in the room. It's not that everybody walked out of there agreeing, but that people had managed to rehumanize each other. And so they took that method and they moved into other difficult conversations and formed the nonprofit to help divided communities become a community again and a really functional community. So that was in 1989, and that actually happens to be the same year that I met a guy named John Saroof our first morning at breakfast at Bowdoin College, and we became friends at that time. We were not connected at all to public conversations, but John showed up in Dallas in 2014 doing some work for them. He had become a really, really, I think, gifted conflict mediation specialist. And he and I reconnected and we had dinner. And the more he was talking about this work he was doing, the more I was connecting it with my work. I am a religious studies professor at Southern Methodist University. I've been teaching in this field for 20 years. And especially as I've been moving into mentoring graduate students, I realized that we don't equip people to have the difficult conversations that will come up in our classrooms. Matter of fact, most folks are told not to talk about religion. And so we get a room full of people coming from all over the world, literally, who don't know how to even begin to approach what we do. And again, the more we were sort of sitting there and thinking together and then continued that conversation, we realized that maybe there was room for his work in classrooms. And he was also interested in what I knew about college campuses as he was being called in to do things like free speech issues, where they had gone badly.
And when you teach religion, you teach it to a number of students who are only taking it to satisfy a requirement and who may not really have an academic interest in it, correct?
Absolutely. Most of my students are business students and engineers, actually.
Okay. So when you brought this method of reflective structured dialogue into the classroom, how did you structure it so that it worked in a classroom setting?
You know, I think it actually works. The fundamentals of it look about the same, right? So reflective structured dialogue is exactly that. I'm going to take a minute and just sort of tell you what it is. It is at first reflective. So we'll ask people to take a minute and think about. And usually, actually, the first round of this thing, we're asking you to think, tell us a story. Think about a time when that would help us explain how it is you come to understand an issue or why you feel about something. So for doing something like abortion, tell me a story that would help me understand why it is you feel the way you do. And we try to use very neutral language in that. I'm not going to use pro-life. I'm not going to use pro-choice. But I'm going to ask you to take a few minutes and think about that story. And throughout this process, and there are two or three other rounds that I'll get to, we're going to ask you to reflect before you speak. And that gives you some time to really dig a little bit deeper into your own understanding of something. And it might make you also a little more open to listening to someone. Turns out reflection is a predecessor to listening well. And then the structured part is that we go in rounds. I have students in small circles. Everybody speaks and listens for the same amount of time, and we enforce that with a timer. This is one thing that cell phones are really great for. They all come with timers. And so we'll give you 90 seconds or 2 minutes. For your turn, everybody will listen, and then you pass the timer to the person on your right or left, and it's their turn until you've gone around the entire circle. And again, we'll do this in rounds. The first one is the tell a story round, usually. And usually the second round will ask you to dig a little bit deeper. What are the values underneath that for you? What's the heart of the matter for you? And then that third round, we're usually going to ask, where are you pulled? As it turns out, most of us, even if we have a strong opinion about something, feel conflicted. It may have our values bumping up against each other. And that's where a lot of the complexity will come out. And so in classroom use, it really looks that way. I'll also do something called dialogic moments, where I'll just ask students to reflect for a couple of minutes, for example, about a time when maybe they understood what something was for and they didn't understand that before. And I'm using that to get at actually some really heavy philosophy around like arguments for the existence of God. There's an argument out there, the teleological argument, that says we can infer God exists because of a designer. And I wanted them to sort of query some of the assumptions in the argument. And so I had a student talking about that moment when she realized what a cigarette lighter was for in a car, because she'd never understood that people maybe had actually lit cigarettes with it before that, a couple of years ago. And she had this aha moment around this issue. And so what she came to understand is, while there is a function for something, we may not always know what that is. And that led her to a much more nuanced reading of that argument. And so what we've come to do then is craft what we call dialogic classrooms around all kinds of reflections like that and moments for people to share. And it has really brought people's stories into the classroom and had people connect with each other in ways I've just never had prior to that.
And when you talk about these religious topics, you do structure your semester, so you don't start with the most controversial topics right at the outset. So what are some of the topics you choose at the beginning of the semester to get them to practice this before they talk about something like homosexuality or abortion?
Yeah, so it's my colleague and partner on this, John Saruf, and we'll talk about it as a dialogue muscle. And so just like you don't walk into the gym and start lifting 600 pounds, or maybe you do, but I certainly don't. We need to walk people up to this and also build a certain amount of trust and familiarity with it before we're asking people to get into something where they feel like it might be more dangerous. And so, for example, there's a course I teach on social scientific methods in the study of religion. And we will eventually in that class go to a gun dialogue, but we don't start with a gun dialogue. We actually start with a dialogue on polyamory. So I start asking them about having, you know, maybe could we have a marriage system where you could marry more than one person, for example? And that one, most people don't have a dog in the fight. Most people are against plural marriages of whatever kind. But what's interesting in that conversation is the more they dig into why, they realize that their convictions are formed from a variety of places, or maybe they don't know where they come from. Folks on the religious end of things tend to say, well, because I'm a Christian, for example, and Christians don't believe in polyamory. And then they start thinking about it and they say, yeah, but there are a lot of people with more than one spouse in the Bible. So I'm going to have to figure out what's going on. But again, that dialogue for me has been very interesting because students from different cultures will point out, you know, for example, I had a Chinese foreign student who pointed out, you know, where he's from in China, that actually you can kind of get away with it if you simply have enough money. And he was critical of that system. He didn't think it was fair. Somebody from South Africa was talking about the time the president of South Africa a few years ago got busted for having more than one family and how she felt about that. And it opened up a world for my other students that they didn't really know existed there. But again, that was a chance to build trust in the system and learn the system so that by the time we got to guns and homosexuality, both of those in that class, my students were able to really trust that they would be held up by that structure in the dialogues and could share what was true for them, even though they knew that everybody else in the room wouldn't necessarily agree.
So how do guns relate to religion?
So I used the gun dialogue. This came up for the first time 2 years ago in that same social science class, although with a different set of students. Parkland had just happened, and we were going to read a piece on religious violence. It's actually a piece that describes religion as averting social violence. It's a way we can, it's by René Girard, and his theory of religion is that we use religion so that we can take sort of vengeful actions out of society as a regular thing. And we had been slated to do a different dialogue, but because of the Parkland stuff, I asked students, would it make more sense for you to dive into guns, and are you willing to go there? I did sort of it's equivalent of an airline, you know, safety row exit check. You know, I need a nod from everyone or we're not going to proceed. And they wanted to do it. It made me incredibly nervous. I never thought of guns as something I would be willing to really even bring up in any classroom. But I had watched my partners in this work do it very successfully on a national level. And I knew my students were thinking about it a lot. And they clearly wanted to do it. And so we talked about the theory. I put them into the dialogue circles. They had a very productive discussion and dialogue about guns. They actually came to understand that guns meant different things for everybody in the room. A student from North Carolina talked, his story about guns was that he grew up in a very rural place and that he ran around shooting stuff in his backyard, which when it came to the freer part of things at the end of these structured dialogues where you can ask curious questions of each other. My student from very urban California had been dying to ask the entire time, how big is your backyard? She couldn't picture his way of being. And they came to understand that when she was thinking of guns, she was thinking of a sort of imagined gang violence around her from her place that she grew up in. And the student from North Carolina, of course, was thinking about, you know, pellet guns and BB guns and things he'd grown up with in a town that didn't have a movie theater. It's what you did for entertainment. And so they had this profound moment of realizing they weren't even talking about the same thing. And then they could take that idea, and when we turned it back into the religious studies theory and I asked them to evaluate the theory on the basis of the conversation, they had really smart things to say. Some of them were more skeptical of the theory. Some of them were more accepting. And it was the best discussion I've ever had. And to this day, they'll actually remember the theorist's name, which is also something that never used to happen.
That is impressive.
It sticks.
Yeah, especially for a non-religion major.
Yeah, and they were spelling it right 6 weeks later. So, I'm really, really pleased with what this will do for a learning environment in a classroom.
And one of the things you and some other people are doing now is teaching the system to faculty.
Yeah.
Faculty, not just in religion, but in a variety of disciplines. And as you mentioned at the beginning, faculty are nervous about talking about these topics. So how do you teach faculty to, you obviously talk about the stages of the process, but how do you teach them about being less nervous and trying things out?
So one thing we talk about at the very beginning is why this is so hard. Why is it we feel so nervous about talking about national politics or the upcoming election? And it goes back to brain biology. As it turns out, your brain can't tell the difference between a viewpoint threat and a physical threat. So if you're about to get hit by something or someone, or somebody says something that goes counter to a deeply held worldview that you hold, your brain does the same thing, right? And it actually floods you with chemicals that are designed for fight or flight or freeze. And once you can see that, and we talk about how long you're in that state and why it's so counterproductive to rational thinking and all of that, it's much easier to address it in a space. And I think, you know, that exercise is one of the most powerful things we do with faculty, to say, you're not crazy for thinking this feels dangerous. You're not crazy for thinking that students are really on edge about these things, or that you're really on edge. But then we can give you some tools for doing this in such a way that you're held, you know, that you have a, something to fall back into. And most faculty walk away not exactly confident, but confident enough that they can start trying it. And once they do, it sort of builds from there.
And you say that anyone can use it and that you can't break it.
Yeah.
Tell me a little more about that.
Well, so the other thing we've learned is that because the structured dialogues look so inflexible, and indeed they are a little bit inflexible once you've structured them and you've started, everybody has to follow these rules that we've crafted, very carefully structured communication agreements. But that's the, while it's the central practice, it isn't the whole thing. And it's why we shifted to this conversation about dialogic classrooms, which is where you use those principles of open-mindedness and curious questions and intentional listening and what we might call resilient listening. And you spread them out as you see fit as an instructor, and you sort of scaffold your class so that the stuff is everywhere and it becomes a value in the classroom. And that's going to look different for everybody. I don't teach sociology, but sociologists use it in all kinds of ways when they're talking about birth and death, for example. But what they're doing with that looks pretty different than when I have it or when an English professor has it. A really talented colleague of mine who teaches English starts a conversation even before she assigns the book. She assigns Joy Luck Club, but she wants her students to really think about immigrant experiences, even though most of them aren't immigrants. And so she has them do a conversation, a dialogue about what it is to be an American. And so she's managed to use this in a way so different than I would use it, but it's incredibly effective for her students. They talk about having an insight into the regionality of the United States that they never had before, for example, that what it is to be an American is kind of different in some important ways if you're from Ohio than California. And at the same time, they can find some commonalities there too. And so the not breaking it part is the idea that you can be brave with this. You can take it into spaces where you think it's going to serve your purpose. You'll have to know what the purpose is and make it look like what you need it to look like.
Have you ever had any feedback from a faculty member who said, oops, I did break it?
There have been some dialogues that didn't go so well, but they've never used the I did break it.
Right.
A couple of times people have come back saying it didn't do what I wanted it to do. I don't feel like my students really understood why we were doing it, or they didn't really connect with each other. I've never had a world on fire story. I've never heard a faculty member come back and say my entire class is ruined because of it. What we're getting is stories where people perhaps didn't scaffold the class well enough or didn't say their own intention to students. The students really didn't know why they were doing it or really weren't prepared as well. And that's where we get feedback where students are like, yeah, it was an experience, but I'm not sure what I got there. So that's one thing. To do it better, a faculty member really does have to spend a lot of time in preparation and scaffolding the experience for students so they do know why they're doing it and they can bring something away from it. And one part of that is continued reflection after the event so the students can hook it up to their own experience, then also to the experiences in the class and to the content.
And going back to the basics of the system, one of the principles is speaking to be understood. So can you unpack that?
So we usually contrast that with speaking to persuade. If you look at our national discourse, you have a lot of models of people who are simply trying to persuade you of something. And so they may not even let you finish a sentence, or they, you know, and they're just telling you why they think you should think about something. And speaking to be understood, instead of trying to persuade somebody, you are telling them to the best of your ability why it is you have come to this position. So that's the tell me a story part of this, right? It could be, I feel very strongly about abortion because of an experience I had when I was 16 in my high school, right? Or something more recent. And that could be on either side of the issue. So I'm not trying to persuade you to feel this way. I'm just telling you about my own experience. And it's a really different way of speaking. Right. So again, it's not the sort of talk show talking over a lot of what we get in things like Congress, radio, internet. You know, most of the internet comments we see are not just you trying to explain yourself. They're you trying to persuade somebody else that they're wrong. And so we want to back off of that. And we found that this is a really helpful way to frame, just tell me the story. Just do your best. Tell me why you think this is true because of this experience that you have or the values that you hold or both.
So what do you do when you get questions from students who say, I do want to go into politics or law and I do want to persuade people to do something?
So absolutely. When you're writing me a paper, I need you to persuade me. Absolutely. That's what the academy does. That is our mode of discourse for the most part. This is prior to that. You cannot persuade me if you don't understand it yourself. And the best way to understand it yourself is to step back and to listen to understand. And by listen there, actually, I want to take that metaphorically in this case. What we're noticing is students do a much better job on research when they have this in the back of their mind that they should be open-minded, that they should listen to understand, read to understand before they're making that sort of persuasive decision. Then you can proceed to persuade. By all means, go out and persuade after you figured this out. But use this opportunity to engage in a broader way. Right? So liberals worry that we're sort of preventing them from going out and protesting. No, I want you to protest if you feel really strongly about something. But I want you to spend some time understanding why and how it is you feel this way. And then keep that human connection. Even if you disagree with somebody, you can still understand that they're a human being who may feel very strongly for similar reasons that you do. They simply have come down on the opposite side of the issue.
So what do you do if someone brings up the fact that sometimes violence or a war has been used to settle a problem? So for example, in the US, the Civil War did end slavery.
Sure.
Do you ever get that counter argument?
No, no one's ever pushed back that way. Most of us would have preferred to settle slavery some other way, I think. None of this is saying that sometimes other things aren't required. Again, sometimes you have to go protest. I want you to go protest. What this is doing is different work. This is work that has a different intention to it, and I think a different impact to it. The hope would be in a divided community. Once we've gone to war, it takes a whole lot to bring people back together. The idea is that you could sort of shift a conversation in a different way before you get to that point. So it is in no way designed to completely replace other modes of discourse, I would say. You know, and there are times in front of a class where I have to get up and lecture, for example.
Right.
You're not going to dialogue your way to the, you know, Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. That's not how that works. So what it is designed to do, though, is create really intentional connections between people and allow people to see things from different lenses that are provided to them by colleagues, such that they'll have a more comprehensive view of something. And again, at more national levels, that comprehensive view is not necessarily one of kumbaya and peace, but would be more informed.
Right. And you have pointed out that sometimes it can be very, very hard for a student to express their perspective because they know it's controversial and you have to be ready to intervene. So what strategies would you recommend to faculty who need to be ready to intervene?
So the beginning is actually much prior to the event where you think you may need to intervene. We teach people that to even begin these conversations, you have to have rules of the road. We call them communication agreements. And I actually have started crafting those using an exercise that my partners have come up with called Moments of Dissent. I ask students to think about a situation in which seven people in class have all said something that runs really counter to an experience that you've had or a value that you hold deeply. What conditions are going to have to be in place, both internally for you and then externally in the classroom for you to speak? And we have them reflect on that, and then we use their answers to that to craft class communication agreements. And what those agreements do is allow me then, as a facilitator and teacher, to intervene if somebody violates the agreement. So if one of our class agreements is, for example, sharing airtime, everybody will have time to speak. If somebody's starting to interrupt, I can say, I'm going to stop you there. That's violating this agreement. Can you hold that until it's your turn? Right? Or if it's, you know, something like respect, if somebody says something, for example, we usually try to parse out respect because that's a pretty vague term. So we generally say something like, you speak for yourself and not for a group, address somebody else and not a group, an imagined group of which they're a part. So if that would be a case where you're like, oh, you liberals. Then I could flag that and say, so we had this agreement about respect or about speaking for yourself and addressing somebody only as them. Could you rephrase that so that you're not making somebody into this amorphous group that isn't actually represented in the room? And that is magic. Because when you've done it a couple of times, people really start to just embody those rules. They will stop speaking. They will turn to everybody else and listen for somebody else to speak. And I honestly don't have to intervene very much in the course of a semester because they have so embodied the ethic of this thing. And one place where I really knew it was working early on is when I had a class that had just turned into this curiosity engine. Somebody would say something, and then they turn around at all of the rest of the people in the room and they just say, and so what do you think about that? And it would just happen. And I was not having to pull opinions out of people or connect to the readings even. They were even doing that all by themselves because they had just made this ethic and community within the class.
When it comes to essential partners, which you mentioned at the beginning, you're still working with them a little bit too. So tell me a bit about the projects they're doing now, both inside and outside classrooms.
So Essential Partners is continuing their work. The classroom work is newer for them. That really started with that conversation in Dallas, although they'd been working in co-curricular areas on campuses for a long time before. They're continuing to train faculty all over the country, both in open enrollment workshops and then colleges will call them in. And they're continuing their work in divided communities. About 25% of their work, as I understand it, is in faith communities, who are facing issues around homosexuality, for example. And they will help have those difficult conversations. They're working on Israel-Palestine and really all over. You know, anywhere that there's conflict, people will call them in.
So you're at Southern Methodist University, and Methodists are in the news a little more than other denominations for conflicting positions about homosexuality. So when you do have some kind of dialogue at, let's say, a specific church, what is the outcome there? Like, what is the, if ultimately people don't change the positions, but understand where the other person is coming from, they still usually are conflicting about some sort of written policy toward homosexuality and whether it should change or not. So how does Essential Partners assist with that policy creation?
Well, they get people into the place where they can stay in community enough to create a policy, I think would be the short answer there. Or make the difficult decision to split if that's more appropriate. Most people want to stay in relationship. And so the ability to actually talk about those issues is something that doesn't necessarily come naturally to us. You can probably think about some taboo topic in your own family. And it's especially taboo because you do want to stay in relationship there. And so to really move forward, you have to craft a condition under which people feel like they can genuinely be themselves and have these conversations. And that's the work that they do. And again, I think sometimes this is not going to result in a community that can continue. Hopefully it would result in at least an amicable split, or at least the ability to talk about it better, especially across things like hierarchical divides. So how is it pastors can talk to congregants about what's happening at the General Assembly for the United Methodist Church? I mean, congregants aren't there. I mean, that's all hierarchy. And so there's a huge issue right now, I think, with communication down those lines. And that's work that we're interested in pursuing as well.
It's interesting. I go to a Unitarian Universalist congregation, and we're moving to a new building that's a former Methodist church that was abandoned because of a split. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. As an American religious historian, I can tell you schism is something we do really well here, unfortunately.
Right.
But so you are part of the great American story. A congregation I was working with the class in world religions here, it's now a West Indian Hindu temple that had been a synagogue and was Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall in between.
Wow. That's something. Yeah.
So,
yeah. And you mentioned you did your undergrad at Bowdoin. It's funny, I applied to Bowdoin. I would have started in 95 had I been accepted. I ended up going to Davidson. But when it comes to liberal arts colleges, there's actually some research showing that Northeastern liberal arts colleges are, they tend to attract student bodies that are very liberal and very activist. So do you ever do workshops in that area or talk to faculty in that area and find that they have unique problems? Or do you find that in general it's not that different?
I think it's really not that different. And we're all after about the same thing, no matter what our student population is. My campus is overwhelmingly conservative. But when I talk to faculty who are at those more liberal places, we find we're up against much the same sort of social dynamics, which is students who are either unengaged or too busy to be engaged or afraid of actually talking about the upcoming election or whatever the thing is. There's sort of some different social ethics that come out regionally. Southern students tend to be less likely, I think, to want to speak in a classroom. So we have to do more work to make them feel that that's a social norm. But it's really unique in generally, not just to the campus, but to the professor and to the subject matter and what they want to do with this. And so I'm finding those broad generalizations are actually really difficult and not particularly helpful as we help people craft and imagine courses that they're going to teach. So one thing we'll have people do when we have them for a longer amount of time is actually make a poster where they draw the course and then draw little points where dialogue will intersect with the course for them. And they're, they look really different just depending on the subject matter and the professor and their imagination. And I don't find that those are bounded by a school type or region as much.
That's good to know.
The one thing that is different would be just the size of classes. We're really working on getting this scaled so that if you have a class of 300, right, if you're teaching this massive introductory history course, for example, at a large public university, how could you use this? Right. Or conversely, if you have a really small class, if you have a class of 7 and something like a Bowdoin, how could you mix up the group enough to make it continually interesting? And those are challenges for us, and we're still working on them.
Well, Jill, thanks for joining us on the show. It's been great having you.
Well, great. Thanks so much.
You can find out more about the dialogue techniques we discussed at the Essential Partners website, whatisessential.org. Jill and her colleagues are also working on a book called The Listening Revolution, Teaching for Engagement and Curiosity. To learn more about her work, you can email her at detemple@smu.edu. The show notes also include links to 2 articles from Teaching Theology and Religion about her work, and a video of a dialogue on gun policy featuring John Sirouf. If you enjoyed listening to the show, please leave us a review on iTunes because it helps spread the word about the show. And as always, you can reach me at podcast@heterodoxacademy.org and follow me on Twitter at ChrisMartin76. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDX Academy, and on Facebook.